Welcome to another Domestic Preparedness Podcast interview. Since 1998, DomesticPreparedness.com has published critical solutions for the professional preparedness community. Today's interview is sponsored by Canberra Industries, the world's leading supplier of analytical instruments, systems, and services for radiation detection and monitoring. Your host today is the managing editor, John Morton.
Domestic Preparedness is back with R. James Woolsey, Booz Allen Hamilton Vice President. For 22 years, Mr. Woolsey was a partner at the Washington law firm of Shea & Gardner, but Don Prep members will recognize him as well as former Director of Central Intelligence and President George Herbert Walker Bush's senior arms control negotiator in Vienna. In the 1970s, he served as Undersecretary of the Navy, and these are among the highlights of his many years of long and distinguished government service. Last year, when we were together, our discussion focused on intelligence sharing and related risk assessment and critical infrastructure protection, among other things. But this year, I want to talk about the threat posed by Hezbollah in light of Israel's recent military action in Lebanon and the ongoing international crisis over Iran's nuclear program. Jim, it's a pleasure to be back here speaking with you today. I hope you had a good year since we were last together.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Good to be with you.
Well, for the first segment, I want to talk about the question, who is Hezbollah? And I remember a luncheon speech you gave at one of my military conferences several years back when you spoke of our being engaged in World War IV. Would you tell our Don Prep members what you mean by that characterization and how Hezbollah fits into your view of this titanic struggle in which we are engaged?
Well, I borrowed that from my friend Elliot Abrams. Elliot Cohen, who wrote an article by that title, an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal just after 9/11. And his point was that the war we're in now is going to be long like what he called World War III, the Cold War, and has some other parallels to the Cold War. And he was trying to emphasize what a big deal it was going to be and how long it was going to take. I used that formulation for a while, but if you talk about world war in these contexts, people think of D-Day and Iwo Jima and Battle of the Marne and so forth, and they think of something that's going to be relatively short, a few years and very, very violent and military in its characteristics. And so that doesn't work real well. Newt Gingrich is talking now about World War III. I think even though there's something wrong with all these formulations, that's still better than the administration's title that they've used for several years now, the Global War on Terror or Terrorism. As John Lehman says, we didn't call World War II in the Pacific Global War on Kamikazes. You don't just fight against the tactic. You're fighting against an enemy. I think probably one of the better ones recently is talking about the war on Islamic fascism. Mm. It connotes a lot of the right things, but I've been saying that it is, unfortunately, a real insult to Mussolini because the Italian fascists were absolutely horrible, but they were not explicitly racist or theocratic or genocidal. They unfortunately helped the Nazis round up Jews, but their own doctrine was not that they should exterminate the Jews or anybody else. So actually it would be more accurate to call Hezbollah and their Iranian masters or sponsors anyway, and Al-Qaeda and the Wahhabis of Saudi Arabia, Islamic Nazis. President's gone with fascists. I'll stick with that for a while.
Well, Hezbollah, like Al-Qaeda, is a non-state actor in international politics with some 50,000 members. But it also has 9 seats in the Lebanese parliament and controls 3 others. It's not like an Al-Qaeda operating in an ungovernable region of a failed state, is it?
It's more establishment than that. It has a much closer relationship to Iran and to some extent Syria, I think, than Al-Qaeda does to any government since we overthrew the Taliban. And it is an independent actor as well, but it was, for all practical purposes, until this last war in June and July, it was the government of southern Lebanon, and dominated in some ways much of the government of Lebanon itself by way of being an armed militia and having the representatives in the parliament and the rest. It's a unique institution and an extremely dangerous one.
Mm-hmm. It even has its own TV network, yes. Al-Manar.
Yes.
You ever watch that?
I've watched clips that MEMRI, the Mideast Media Research Institute, which does wonderful work putting all of that, both the bad and the good from the Middle East, into a quickly and easily translated and easily digestible format. We've had some luck. I do some work from time to time with Cliff May at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and they've had some success in campaigning to get Al-Manar off Western networks, but it still is in important many parts of the world, and particularly the Middle East.
Well, now the Lebanese national, is it Imad Mughniyeh, is Hezbollah's security chief. Now he's in Iran, I think, and I understand he travels only to Syria and Lebanon. What exactly is his role?
Well, he was the mastermind behind several of the terrorist attacks of the 80s, and he's operationally essentially the operational head of Hezbollah, and he's an extremely shrewd and crafty man. I can't think of many other terrorists, other than bin Laden and Zawahiri, that we would probably want to capture or kill as much as Mughniyeh.
Mm-hmm. In this section, I'd like to talk a little bit about what Hezbollah has been up to in the Western Hemisphere. It is one of the best organized terrorist group, if not the best organized terrorist group in the Western Hemisphere. It bombed the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires in 1992. And like its bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut in 1983, that decision was made by Iran. So with Iranian backing, would you say Hezbollah could mount a series of strikes anywhere in this hemisphere?
Perhaps not anywhere, and perhaps not a series, but they could certainly mount strikes. I think we're relatively unlikely to see in this country, even if Hezbollah takes it on, phenomenon such as the Second Intifada, with a lot of Hezbollah people having roots in different parts of American society and blowing up places like shopping centers and so forth, the way the Hamas particularly did in Israel. I think our law enforcement and our relations with most of our immigrants are better than that and would be able to keep something like that from happening. But it doesn't mean they couldn't pull off a single big operation, or one or two.
Mm-hmm.
And they are extremely clever and plan very well. So I would be worried more about something like a few very major attacks on infrastructure than I would about a large number of relatively small attacks, such as a suicide bomber in a mm-hmm. shopping center.
Well, they have offshore havens that we should be monitoring. I'm thinking of, in particular, the Venezuelan island of Isla Margarita. Do you have any thoughts about those kinds of areas offshore that where their activity is pronounced?
Only that Venezuela is more and more of a problem with terrorist groups and rogue states. It's not that Chavez is just working this sometimes. It's the centerpiece of his rule. Mm-hmm. And whether offshore or somewhere in the wilds of Venezuela, any kind of tie between Venezuela and Hezbollah is extremely troubling because it's so close.
Mm-hmm.
And because they could help provide a lot of the infrastructure and training and so forth to help them, for example, get across the southern border of the United mm-hmm. States. That's a serious problem.
Well, for a decade or more, we've had the term narco-terrorism. There is a convergence of terrorist and criminal networks, to be sure. And I gather Hezbollah doesn't create its own capability when it can use its own local criminal networks that may be nearby where it's operating for things like false visas and forgeries. Now, are we seeing that more and more, this convergence?
I'm not sure, but I think it has probably helped that the war against the cocaine drug lords and so forth is going better in Colombia than it was a few years ago. It's certainly not drying anything up, and Hezbollah will look everywhere for precisely the type of interactions with criminal groups that you describe. I think that part of the difficulty here is that now that oil is so high and the Iranian contribution is can be almost whatever they want it to be, Hezbollah doesn't need to be nearly as much of a moneymaker to carry out these kinds of operations as it might have back in the late 90s when oil was $10 a barrel.
Mm. In this segment, I'd like to talk a little bit about the immediate threat in the United States. When we come to our doorstep, the Millennium plot to bomb LAX airport comes to mind. The plot was disrupted when Ahmad Rassam came through Port Angeles, Washington, and caught the attention of sharp-eyed customs officers. Now, do you think Hezbollah sees Canada as a launching pad for attacks against the U.S.?
I'm sure they must. That border is so unguarded for so many miles in so many places that and Canada has reasonably liberal travel and immigration laws, so getting into Canada is not as difficult as one might hope. Mm-hmm. And getting across the border from Canada in the United States is, I'm afraid, in many circumstances ridiculously easy. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a very serious problem.
Jim, here's some stats that I think our members might want to know about if they don't already. We've got 35 million Arab Americans in the country. Two-thirds live in 10 states. A third live in California, New York, and Michigan. The majority are Christians, but 23% are Muslims. 95% live in metro areas, and the top five are L.A., Detroit, New York, New Jersey, Chicago, and Washington. Now, they are mostly Lebanese, although in New Jersey most are Egyptians, and in Rhode Island most are Syrians. The Arab Americans are great Americans, highly educated with higher incomes and lower unemployment rates than most other immigrant populations. But if you take Detroit, a heavily Lebanese Shiite area, some call Dearborn, where a third of its 100,000 residents claim Arab ancestry, they call it Hezbollah Central. Aside from Dearborn, Detroit, Hezbollah has operated in some 14 cities in the U.S., including Houston, Louisville, Kentucky, and Charlotte, North Carolina. So my question to you is, would you say that Hezbollah might be taking a leaf out of Mao's book, moving among the people as a fish swims in the sea?
They will try, but there are a number of barriers. One is that we really do a better job of integrating immigrants than almost anyone. The Canadians and the Aussies sometimes do as well. But compared to Europe, including even Britain, our immigrant populations, including our Muslim and Arab immigrant populations, are on the whole extremely well integrated into American life. As you mentioned, less than a quarter of the Arab Americans are Muslim. So the predominance of Arab Christians, whether Maronite or Coptic or whatever, gives us a large number of people to draw on. I would say the same thing is true of some of the Sephardic Jewish communities, of people who speak Arabic and can help us as translators, interpreters, and police officers, whatever. And we can't discriminate against having Muslims in those roles too, but we don't have to exclusively go with Muslims. The other point is that the Muslim community in the United States, until very recently, was not only heavily South Asian, but heavily professional. Most Muslim immigrants to the United States who came a few years ago are a lot are Pakistani. Some are Indian Muslims, but they are, on the whole, business people and lawyers and physicians and doctors and engineers. And only in relatively recent years have we seen something of a beginning of a Muslim influx of poorer and less educated immigrants into the U.S. from the Muslim world. You put that together, all of that, with the history of, you know, you come here and put on a baseball cap and the kids join a little league and the Boy Scouts and people become Americans. We really do that pretty well. Mm-hmm. So we've gotten tips, I think, in Lackawanna and the terrorist group and in Florida. We tend to get tips from the American Arab and American Muslim community. I'm sure it doesn't always happen, but I've heard a lot about information sharing over the last few years, and I keep saying the most important information sharing is the information that Mrs. Hassan, who runs the corner of 7-Eleven in Dearborn, would share with Officer O'Reilly as he walks the beat. And if she says, "Officer, you know, there are three young guys from Yemen in this apartment upstairs. They never seem to go out, and I heard them shouting excitedly about something about explosives the other day. You might want to check it out." That's our major line of defense. Once Mrs. Hassan stops talking to Officer O'Reilly, we've got a big problem. So I would say Hezbollah will try. They'll try hard to swim in the sea of the people, as Mao would have put it. But I don't think they'll make much progress in numerical terms. Still, you have to count on the probability that here and there, someone with a really murderous terrorist intent and training is going to succeed in smuggling himself, almost always a him, into the country and not being discovered. Almost certainly will happen, but I don't think it'll happen anywhere like in the numbers that it seems to be happening in Europe.
Now, the Hezbollah cell that was in Charlotte, North Carolina, was a perfect operation in one sense, because Hezbollah was using a Lebanese community where local law enforcement was not really focused at that time on the terrorist threat. Now, that seems to be a pretty good strategy, though. Do you think we'll see that again?
Yeah, it's clever to operate in a, you know, sort of nice medium-sized town like Charlotte, or maybe my hometown of Tulsa, Oklahoma. I don't think Oklahoma City would have thought itself as a center of terrorism before the bomb of the Murrah building, and it's still not entirely clear who did all that. We know who McVeigh and his colleague were, of course, two principal bombers, but there could well have been somebody else involved. And the real problem here, I think, is not American Muslims. It's the institutions. Because Wahhabi money funds a lot of the radical institutions on the Sunni side, you have mosques and with radical literature and Islamic study centers and so forth. And I think probably on the Shiite side in far less numbers because the money's available. You have some things getting brought into the country and used in institutes and so forth from the Iranian / Hezbollah side. Mm-hmm. So I think that we need to pay particular attention not just to Shiite or Sunni potential terrorists who are already talking about blowing something up. Mm-hmm. We need to look out for the ones who want to establish a caliphate or get the Mahdi to return and get as many people killed as quickly as possible. To put ourselves on the alert. And we're going to have to go back and look at some of the ways we dealt with this in the Cold War. Mm-hmm. For example, we tried to make it illegal to be a communist in the United States. Congress did, the Smith Act, and it was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. So they went back to the drawing board in the early 50s and came up with the McCarran Act, which didn't try to make communism illegal, but it made it awfully uncomfortable to be an American communist. You had to register every time you turned around, and the FBI was infiltrating your party by, you know, to a fairly well. American Communist Party by the 50s was saying, look, we're not in favor of a violent revolution. We're going to bring about a communist dictatorship in North America by running Gus Hall for president. But we didn't ban them, but we made it awful tough for them to get anything done. And somehow we have to look back to the lessons of those times. And where we have somebody in an organization that effectively supports Hezbollah's way of thinking and doctrine, or Mesbiyazdis and Ahmadinejads, or the Wahhabis, Al-Qaeda, we need to find a way to keep track of what they're doing, even before somebody says, okay, here we are, alone in my garage now, let's plan blowing up the Brooklyn Bridge. And to date, our legislation and the doctrine and practices of the FBI on things like Hezbollah associated groups is that you really require what they call a criminal predicate in order to start an investigation, sometimes even to hold newspaper clippings. And we need to take a look at that and see if there's some way we can deal with this more effectively, the way we did with the American communists during the Cold War.
Well, getting back to the question of the criminal activity that Hezbollah had been doing, the Charlotte Dearborn operation was financing was from cigarette smuggling, and there was also an element of tax evasion and credit card fraud and drug running. There's gun running, gun trafficking, internet porn. Is there anything else on the radar, or as you say, with the oil prices being what they are, is the necessity for the criminal activity not quite what it was 10 years ago?
I think the necessity is going down. They may still do it to help establish some local autonomy and control and to be able to do what they want to do to some extent rather than just taking Iranian money. But, you know, with oil at $70 a barrel approximately, Iran makes something close to $50 billion a year from its oil sales, whereas it was more like $5 to $10 billion a year back in the late 90s. So they can afford, just as the Wahhabis get money from Saudi Arabia, Hezbollah, and the radical groups get money from Iran, and they can afford to finance themselves through you're and my pulling into the gasoline pump instead of having to go to the trouble of getting themselves exposed to cigarette smugglers.
In this section, let's talk a little bit about some of the law enforcement responses to the challenges. People used to talk about the FBI's Chinese wall that separated the Bureau's intel units from its criminal units. Is that still a problem?
Yes. Not as much of one, I think, as it was. But it's still a difficulty, this business of needing a criminal predicate to get into doing surveillance is an aspect of that. We really succeeded quite well in the mid-1970s as a result of the Church-Pike hearings on the CIA and NSA scandal and the whole business of FBI spying on Martin Luther King Jr. and so on. We succeeded in communicating to the law enforcement community and the intelligence community, you can't get in trouble if you don't do anything. And that is not a good message. We succeeded in making it impossible for the NSA to intercept communications from Al-Qaeda operatives in Europe to cell phones of belonging to somebody in the U.S., and we were unable to pick up that Al-Midar and Al-Hazmi, the two pilots of the flight that flew into the Pentagon, were talking to an Al-Qaeda switch in Yemen. We succeeded in keeping the FBI from looking into Musawi's computer. We succeeded in keeping a smart FBI agent in Minnesota from getting hooked up with another smart one in Arizona and realizing that they both understood pieces of the problem of young Muslim men learning to fly airplanes without learning to land them or take them off. We did all that very well, unfortunately. And we're going to have to unlearn some of those lessons because most of those policies do not come close to being limited constitutionally. They're limited by political correctness, but not by the Constitution. We have a lot more flexibility under the Constitution. As Justice Jackson said once, the Constitution is not a suicide pact. And there are some things one cannot do. Abraham Lincoln should not have suspended habeas corpus. The Supreme Court eventually decided unilaterally, but he could have suspended it with a congressional authorization. There are a number of things that we do, not do now, that we're going to have to change and start working on as we move into this unfortunate world of having suicide bombers and terrorists and killers here inside our fences.
Jim, there are about 66 joint terrorism task forces, one in each of the FBI's major field offices and then 10 in smaller offices. How are these working in your estimation?
I think reasonably well from what I've heard. The basic problem is that the culture of the Bureau is not principally that of running long-term penetration operations. It's one of getting as much information as you need to make an arrest and get a conviction and then shutting things down. Now, it's not that the FBI can't do the former. They ran a long-term operation against the American Communist Party very well back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. They penetrated the mafia effectively on more than one occasion. So it's not that they can't do it. It's that it's not at the heart of their tradition and culture and how you advance yourself in the Bureau. And I've been watching and waiting to see how well they've done post 9/11, and it's coming more slowly than I would like. I don't know if we're ready yet for an American MI5, the British Domestic Investigatory and Counterterrorism Unit that does not have law enforcement responsibility, but we could be headed toward a need for something like that.
Jim, in this last section, let's talk about the future threat. One key Hezbollah cell operated at Boston's Logan Airport, which is where the origin of two of the 9/11 flights were. Do you see any connection there or indeed portents for the future?
Not that I can think of. Logan's security was not good, and it's picked up quite a bit since. But I don't see any particular link between Hezbollah cell and 9/11. It was, as far as we know, all Sunni and not from the Shiite or Iranian side of things.
Well, you mentioned Oklahoma City in a previous section about some question as to who was really behind that beyond Timothy McVeigh. Hezbollah does use false flag operations. Mm-hmm. It seems to be okay with taking only a supporting role in a terrorist operation and will conceal its support if necessary while letting another organization take the credit, sometimes even without knowing it got help from Hezbollah. If the Iranian nuclear issue escalates, would you expect a false flag operation?
Oh, absolutely. If Hezbollah gets involved in trying to smuggle fissionable material into the country, they'll do everything they can to make it look like it's somebody else, say, Al-Qaeda. And matter of fact, Al-Qaeda might try to do everything they can to make it look like Hezbollah. The motto of this part of the world is me against my brother, me and my brother against our cousin, me and my brother and my cousin against the stranger. Mm-hmm. So they have no problem at all undermining one another, trying to get one another blamed for things, double dealing, but then still cooperating on other things.
Synchronized multiple bombings, Hezbollah trademark. I seem to think, from what you said earlier, that you don't see that happening here necessarily. Is there something else that you see?
I think what we need to worry about with Hezbollah is large operations, not a set of synchronized small ones. I think we have to worry particularly about attacks on our infrastructure, things like the electricity grid.
Mm-hmm. Now, the counterintelligence capability Hezbollah has is somewhat legendary. It can be very dangerous. For example, I've heard that when investigators get too close to certain assets, human resources, Hezbollah will target those investigators for execution. Is this entirely true, or does this give us any major concern, or
sure.
does it just go with the territory?
They have no compunctions against doing that sort of thing, or for that matter, taking Lebanese women and children and putting them in a building right next to where they launch a rocket against Israel from, so that they'll get killed when the Israelis respond. They're entirely and completely ruthless with regard to things like that. I don't think they think twice about it at all.
Last question, Jim. You were saying, again, getting back to the power now that is resident in Iran with the oil revenues, it would seem to me that you're suggesting that the Hezbollah support cells in the United States are not quite as necessary for fundraising purposes. So does that mean that they could mutate very, very easily, in your view, into attack cells?
It's possible, depending on the skills of the individuals involved. And I would say it's not that fundraising in the U.S. via crime or otherwise is going to get shut down. It's just that it's become somewhat more optional. Mm-hmm. There are some advantages to them to having control of their own money and raising it themselves. And I think they'll still be involved in some things like this. But the price of oil gives Iran a huge capability to spread its largesse to them most any way it wants.
Well, Jim, it's always an honor to hear your insights. Thank you very much for having us again and the opportunity. And thanks for your service to our country.
Thanks a lot. Great to be with you.
This has been a DomesticPreparedness.com podcast interview.